In the morning, when you want the news, you need the front page every hour on the press box.
Nothing's riding on this except the First Amendment of the Constitution, freedom of the press, and maybe the future of the country. Not that any of that matters.
And now, the news.
As we talked about earlier, the Vegas Golden Knights victorious in Pete DeBoer's debut 4-2 yesterday, and a lineup change as William Karlsson is now week to week. We'll find out more as the days go on, but they do have that blanket of security where the All-Star game is just in a few days, and they could take this time off to maybe reevaluate William's health as the season continues. Buffalo is Saturday night, 4 o'clock. The drop the puck over in Montreal. We'll have Ed Graney live as he heads to Le Habitant at 9 o'clock, but I think for now, this is a good time to actually maybe get some of the ills out. And, you know, like you said, Tyler, what a great way to go and debut a first coach, you know, on a first game on the road in Ottawa.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the ideal spot. And maybe getting away from Vegas is a very good time right now, a very good thing for that team, because they don't have any other distractions other than what they have to do on the ice.
Well, it's probably good not to debut Pete DeBoer at home, because fans might not have been so thrilled to see him at home without anything. Now, he gets 7 games on the road before he coaches a home game. They're 6-1 in that span. Everybody's going to love him. People already like him all now. He had a press conference and won one game. And people are like, all right, we can handle this Pete DeBoer guy. So if they win most of their games over these next 6 before they come back home on February 8th, it'll be fine. People like him.
My friend Mike Tenay, is a longtime wrestling broadcaster, known as the Professor for almost 3 decades on live TV covering professional wrestling with WCW and TNA, and he's a big Golden Knights fan, and he came up with this angle to maybe turn Pete DeBoer into a babyface, which means everyone will like him. He says he should do an interview where he admits VGK deserved to win the playoff series against the Sharks last year. All right, that's number one. And then he says maybe it would be too much to have him do the Fortress thing where they give him a VGK jersey and then he takes off the Sharks jersey, spits and stomps on it.
Oh, the knighting ceremony.
The knighting ceremony.
They do up at the castle
right
at T-Mobile. Those are great. And yes, they should absolutely do that with Pete DeBoer. 100%. They should knight Pete DeBoer. If you don't know, the whole concept is you were a fan of another NHL team because the Golden Knights didn't exist, but now you're a Golden Knights fan, and so you go up, they put you on the video board, you've got a Colorado Avalanche jersey on or whatever.
Right.
You take it off, throw it away, they give you a Golden Knights one, you put it on, you kneel down, and you get knighted.
You've been coronated.
It's terrific. They should absolutely do that with Pete DeBoer. That is a terrific idea, 100%. That should be how they start their first home game.
It seems a little cheesy, but that works in this town.
That's this team.
That's
absolutely
what this team does.
It's hilarious. Right.
I think we got to push that forward, and something's got to happen like that. Where you get ingratiated in Las Vegas, or like you go up and Wayne Newton has rings and you kiss his rings or something like that, where you become a made man.
They have to do something video wise right before that first home game, to where it's like, this is Pete DeBoer now, and completely play into the idea that you just took a coach that you hated less than a year ago.
That's how you turn babyface.
Yes.
They better write this down. Sage, are you out there? Write this thing down. UNLV men's basketball tomorrow. A great afternoon matinee over at the Thomas and Mack Center. This team's rolling. It's 5-1. Tyler Bischoff will be part of the coverage beginning at 1:30 here on ESPN Las Vegas. And I think 3 o'clock is a good time to get everybody out there, because it's perfect part of the day and you don't have to wait till 7. But UNLVtickets.com, 739 fans, let's get out there tomorrow night. It's the blackout. And TJ Otzelberger spoke after yesterday's, on Tuesday's game, speaking about Wednesday's game against San Jose State. The effort that he's getting from the bench, the contributions that's coming from everybody, is actually beginning to turn the team concept into exactly what he thought of months ago when he took the job.
Well, in different moments, different guys stepped up. Like you said, Bryce gave us the energy there. Then Amari to start the second half. I mean, he felt like he had 7 right away where he just came out, got us going. Then Donnie had stretches during the game, huge free throws. It takes everybody. We're a team that it's going to have to take that balance. Different points in the game, different guys need to step up. Today was an example of throughout the game, just when we needed it, guys brought what we needed.
Did you think he was able to get this kind of versatility from everybody and these kind of contributions?
The biggest two have been Marvin Colvin and Bryce Hamilton. Mm-hmm. Because Bryce, I think it's 7 straight now, Bryce Hamilton has scored in double figures. And like last season, Bryce Hamilton the entire year only scored in double figures 3 times. Coming off the bench and playing sporadically. So Bryce Hamilton's biggest problem has been he's not consistent. Like, he shows you flashes of, hey, that looks really good, but then he's got some terrible play. he's been solid. He's been really good, and he's provided them some offense. They've got another guy that can take guys off the dribble when the offense doesn't work. It's pretty much been only Amori Hardy that could do that the first 10, 12, 15 games of the season, but now they've got Bryce Hamilton that can take guys off the dribble when the offense doesn't work and still create a good shot. And I think Bryce Hamilton might be the key to this game against New Mexico, because New Mexico is a fast team. They play in transition more than any other team in the Mountain West, and UNLV probably is going to want to slow this game down. But if this does turn into a fast-paced game, Bryce Hamilton is the best player on this team in transition. If you had one player on the team and said, hey, you've got to make a transition basket, you're picking Bryce Hamilton. So this could be a game for him to not break out, because he's been breaking out for like seven straight games, but this could be a game where he is excellent, because what New Mexico does should sort of play into his skill set. Marvin Coleman is also going to be extremely important against the tempo, because Marvin Coleman looked good against San Jose State when they pushed, because San Jose State is terrible on defense. New Mexico is good defensively, and Marvin Coleman's biggest problem this year is he's got a turnover issue. He, as good as he's been, he has a turnover issue. Shekta Dembele is the only team on the team with a higher turnover rate than Marvin Coleman. So if the game gets sped up and you're playing an actual competent defense in New Mexico, can Marvin Coleman limit his turnovers? If not, he might have seven or eight, and UNLV is going to be completely out of this because of that. So those are the two players I'm looking at. If this does turn into a fast-paced game, they've got to play well.
The Lobos did play a fast-paced game against San Jose State earlier this year in conference play, and they lost, right?
Yeah.
So do you think they overlooked San Jose State in that game, or were they are they trying to get everyone to go play into their strategy and actually push people up and down the floor? Because you know what? When UNLV had to go up and down against San Jose State, they matched up pretty well.
So the problem for New Mexico is their defensive style. It's actually similar to UNLV. Their defensive style, they want to take away layups more than anything. So what that leads to is you are overhelping in the lane and leaving shooters on the three-point line. So both UNLV and New Mexico do the similar thing on defense. So both teams give up a lot of threes. And if you look at New Mexico's losses this year, they almost all come with the opponent knocking down a really high number of threes. Mm. Colorado State, I think it was 19 they hit in the last game, which is absurd,
they didn't,
by the way.
Yeah, so there was no adjustments to knock guys off the perimeter?
Well, it's just sort of a, you know, teams aren't going to always shoot that well. Like, you can make some adjustments, but like...
That's ungodly number,
isn't it? A
team
hits 19. But you go to that San Jose State game, right? San Jose State took 33 threes. They hit 12 in that game, which is 36%. That's just slightly above the college basketball average, but you give up a lot. And if a team shoots well, you've got a good chance to lose, especially if you shoot poorly. And New Mexico's not a good three-point shooting team. So that's... In their losses, that's been one of their biggest problems, is how badly they get beat from the three-point line. So... UNLV, this is a game. UNLV shoots a lot of threes anyways. They're probably going to take a lot of threes in this game. If they can knock them down, they could blow New Mexico out too.
It'll be interesting to watch. 5-1 record heading into New Mexico this Saturday. Tomorrow, 3 o'clock, they tip it off. Thomas and Mack Center. Get down to the arena. 739 fans, UNLVtickets.com. Tyler will be a part of the pregame coverage beginning at 1:30, as well as we'll have NFL Conference Championships on Sunday here on The Leader, followed by the Westgate Show. We'll get into more of that with Brad Powers. But before we do, let's touch on the story that happened where former Raider Antonio Brown finally got somebody finally told him no. And it was his agent, Drew Rosenhaus.
The last person I think he expected to tell him no.
Like, nobody's told him no yet.
Drew Rosenhaus has been going to bat for Antonio Brown for almost a year now. Every time something happens, he's like, Antonio wants to play football. He's focused. And now Drew Rosenhaus has dumped him.
It's not good. You know, it's kind of like Gabe, that agent in the State Farm ad, where it's like, you know, you always tell the guy yes, except if you don't have the app done yet. But his decision comes at where he says, look, I am not going to help you until you get help first. And I think that's probably, that should be like the line of thinking of everybody around AB if they want AB to survive. Because this is a train that's going off the tracks.
This is actually the first thing I've seen that makes me think he's actually never going to play in the NFL again.
Mm.
Like, all of his antics, yeah, whatever. But like his agent telling him, no, you need to get help before I help you. That to me is like finally like saying, no, Antonio Brown probably won't play in the NFL again. Because here's the thing. Antonio Brown's really, really good.
Ultra talented.
He's like, if he came in right now, he's probably one of the 10 best wide receivers in football. So I've always sat here and thought, somebody's going to sign this guy in the offseason. Like, there's no doubt somebody's going to sign this guy. He's too good to just not be signed, even if he's a moron. But Drew Rosenhaus, saying, no, I'm not going to help. I'm not going to be your agent until you get help for whatever's wrong with you. Like, that to me says, okay, he might not actually ever play again. Because if Drew Rosenhaus is telling you no, then you don't have an agent to actually help you go get on a team. So this actually could be the end of Antonio Brown, and I haven't really believed it until now.
Yeah, agents are the great positive spin machines. They never like any negative stories to ever pervade, and they shut everything down as much as possible.
Yes.
Except this time, Drew can't do it, man. Drew has to say something.
Yeah.
And no NFL team will want any part of this unless he does follow his agent's orders.
And Antonio Brown, for all of the bad things he's done, I still think the dumbest thing that he's done is he broadcast everything he does on social media. Like, the recent issue is him posting an Instagram live video yelling and cussing out cops.
Yeah.
And like, and I don't know what the exact context of why they were there, but it's like a 2-minute video of him just cussing at cops. And like, he's the one that posted this.
It wasn't like a hidden camera by somebody else.
There's no Mike Fiers in Antonio Brown's life to turn him in. He's his own Mike Fiers. So like, he's done terrible things, right? And that's the ultimate issue and how he responds to him. But he keeps getting himself in trouble by posting all of this stuff. Like, just stop. Just somebody take his phone and throw it away, and we won't know how bad Antonio Brown is.
And barking on that, back to the MLB cheating scandal, you found something. Now there's breaking news that happened out of WFNZ, the Panthers station in Carolina. Good buddy Mark Seidel out there, too. What is going on? They had a major interview today with Black Jack McDowell.
So Jack McDowell, who pitched for the White Sox, actually won the Cy Young in 1993, he said on WFNZ this morning that in the 80s, they used a camera to steal signs under the direction of Tony La Russa, and that the way that it was set up is they had a camera on the catcher, and then they apparently had some sign, the Gatorade sign in the outfield, and they could control some of the lights on it, and they'd turn the switch to indicate to the batter what pitch was coming.
Oh, my God.
The 80s!
Oh,
they're using cameras
no.
to steal signs in the 80s! And Rob Manfred wants you to think it was just the 2017 Astros. People have been stealing signs for forever.
A light in the outfield?
Yes, yes.
I mean, you're really asking a lot there. Yes. Like, I mean, but to have it connected to the manager's office.
Is excellent. Excellent work by the White Sox. I don't think they were any good, though, so... Again, it all comes back to being good. And the Astros were actually good. The Red Sox were actually good. And people are mad. But when you suck, or when you cheat and suck, nobody's really worried about it.
Tony La Russa, held as like one of the highest gods of current baseball lore. He's like the special advisor now with the Angels.
In the 80s, too.
In the 80s.
This was like 30 years ago.
If you don't think cheating's been going on or will continue to go on,
they put
you're
iPads
a fool.
In the dugout, what, 2 years ago? Every team in baseball is stealing signs. They put iPads in the dugout. They don't have to go to the manager's office anymore.
That's Tyler. I'm Clay. Absolutely befuddled and blown away by all that. Jack McDowell, the whistleblower, 35 years later.
Just let sign stealing be legal however you get it. That's the easiest way to handle this. Just, whatever. We'll broadcast it on the video board up there. Just let it be legal.
We'll come back with NFL Conference Championships with Brad Powers next.
1-3-1. It's the press box.
Sprint out action to the right side. Mahomes holding it. Now fires it late. Kelce gets into the end zone, turning his left shoulder. Touchdown! Kansas City! 20 points in lightning fashion by the Kansas City Chiefs. Great protection. And Travis Kelce is tearing the Texans up.
Oh, thanks to Chiefs Radio, 101.1 The Fox in KC with the call. Coming back here on the Press Box Morning Show, Tyler Bischoff, Clay Baker. We'll have Mike Romala from Las Vegas Sun in about 10, 12 minutes going over the UNLV game against New Mexico. But joining us now, as he does every Friday at this time, getting us in tune with Sunday, the conference championships, it's Brad Powers. Follow him on Twitter at BradPowers7. He's NFL and college football analyst with pregame.com and with Straight Out of Vegas. How are you, Brad? Good morning.
Excellent. How are you guys doing on this fine Friday?
Pretty good. A little weary. We got the company party tonight, so we're trying to stay sober throughout the day so we can make it to the end there at Silverton. Hey, brother, let me ask you about that. So we're coming back. Let's start with the Kansas City Titans game. We see like this is a line that Kansas City could probably... you know, very well manipulate, but at many times you feel very, very strongly towards a dog, and especially people follow the emotional side and the perception of how the Titans have done so well out here. What do your numbers start to tell you about how the Titans do on defense and how they can actually go and keep up and at least keep pace or even stop what Kansas City does on offense? And we just came back with the Travis Kelce touchdown. I mean, at what point do their secondary in Tennessee actually maybe like continue on playing this way, or do they fold in KC?
Well, I think maybe the best way to stop Kansas City for Tennessee is to keep them off the field. And you could, you've certainly been able to do that by running Derrick Henry offensively the last three games, becoming the first player in the history of the NFL with 180 rushing yards three straight games. I think that's probably their best factor. And Henry, in the first meeting between these two teams earlier this season, had 188 yards. I mean, that, to me, would be the best way to defend Kansas City. Just keep them off the field, run Derrick Henry left and right.
So is there a negative relationship to the Titans' chance to win and Ryan Tannehill's total passing yards?
Right, that's what we ought to know. We got props on the line.
Yeah, I would have to think that, I mean, if you're looking to bet Tennessee, I mean, and if you're going to go prop market, I mean, their best chance of winning, you would have to think, if you're looking at Tennessee in this game, you got to go over, what, 110, 115, Derrick Henry rush yards. I know it's way up compared to what it's been, but I mean, you're kidding me. The guy has exceeded it by 70 plus yards in each of the last three games. So I think there's correlation there. I certainly think Tannehill will have a better passing performance than what he's had the last 2 weeks, combining for about 154 total passing yards. But the chances of Tennessee winning a shootout, although they won a shootout in the first meeting, I'm just not buying it. I think if the game's lower scoring, I think Tennessee's got a better chance to win.
What's in-game, if you're looking at this in-game, how far down do the Chiefs have to be before you believe they're not actually going to come back and win?
It's funny, last week, I think, obviously, even the market had that, you know, in mind, because when they're down 24-0, you would expect to be getting a little more than 3-1 on the money line for a team to come back. I mean, I think a lot of people are looking at it because a lot of people had the same thought process. I was expecting 5-1 at minimum, I thought was going to be kind of a ripoff. But when I saw 3-1, I thought, I think a lot of people are thinking just like me at this point. I think it's a totally different style of play that Tennessee runs compared to Houston. So to me, I would certainly be concerned. Anything more than two touchdowns down this week, I would be very concerned the fact that Tennessee can control the ball.
We're speaking with Brad Powers at BradPowers7 on Twitter and part of the pregame.com crew. Go online and check it out, especially Straight Out of Vegas. You have this great show from 3 to 4 on Sports 920 The Game that gets you up to date on all facets of the NFL Conference Championships. Let's move to Green Bay against San Francisco. How did you start to assess that San Francisco is really starting to pull away from the pack earlier in the regular season? Because you felt very strongly about how this team was working. In fact, when they did that Monday night game against Green Bay, you felt very strongly that Green Bay was not going to be up for this game.
Yeah, I mean, it all really comes down to the health of their defense. Maybe it's health, maybe they were tired because San Francisco had a really early bye week back in week 4. So, you know, the question you got to ask yourself is this. I mean, what's the real truth of the 49ers defense? Is it what we saw in the first half of the season and what we saw last week against the Vikings, or is it what we saw down the second half of the season? If you're a believer in the former, being, you know, what you saw last week in the first part of the season, that they're healthy and they're rested, and then I don't know how you don't back San Francisco here, because, I mean, I think Green Bay is an overrated team. I mean, this is a team that's been outgained on the season. They're 9-1 in games decided by 8 points or less. And you just go back to that first matchup. That was during the stretch where San Francisco wasn't playing that well on defense, and yet they completely shut down Aaron Rodgers and company. I mean, Aaron Rodgers was held to 3.2 yards per pass attempt, the second lowest of his, what, career? That's 15 years.
Packers are the worst 13-3 team to be playing in the conference championship season ever, or conference championship in weekend ever?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at their scoring differential, you know, they only outscored their opponents by a combined 63 points. That's the lowest ever for a 13-win team. I would say they're certainly up there. Now, the question you got to ask yourself, if it's a close game in the fourth quarter, I mean, would you rather have Jimmy G or would you rather have Aaron Rodgers? That's the only drawback I have, and that's kind of prevent me from having a big bet on the 49ers.
I think I'd be surprised that if it is close in the fourth quarter, just because I don't think the Packers are going to be able to stop George Kittle or the 49ers from running the ball.
Right.
Yeah, and we've seen teams have a lot of success running, you know, down Green Bay's throat, particularly, you know, the Philadelphia had a lot of success running at Green Bay. I think that's got to be the game plan. And obviously San Francisco has, as far as run efficiency, is about as good as anybody. You get to work the middle of the field with Kittle. Yeah, San Francisco was mighty impressive last week. And this line, I mean, just to face it, I mean, 49ers were a 7-point favorite last week against the Vikings. The fact that they're laying an extra half point against the Packers, the market's telling you Green Bay's overrated.
What do you like? Anything from the totals on either game? Anything kind of stick out to you? 53 for Tennessee, Kansas City, and 46.5 for Green Bay, San Francisco.
Yeah, I'm a little surprised that probably the Tennessee, Kansas City total it's that high. I mean, to me, Tennessee's so much better defensively than Houston. The fact that this total is 2 points higher than what we saw last week, I get it. 2 points didn't matter last week with that total going over by 30 plus against Houston. But I'm a little surprised to see the Tennessee, Kansas City total of 53. I'd lean under there. Really not a strong opinion on the total. Mm-hmm. If you guys are asking me, hey, what's my favorite bet, side or total of these two matchups, I'm going to lay the 7 with the Chiefs.
What if it comes out, we're like, you know, 2 days away from knowing when the Super Bowl, what the teams will be? Probably if it's Kansas City, San Francisco, and you get this number on Sunday night after the game's over, what side would you hammer and what would you look at as far as like a possible line and total for these two games or these two teams?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm expecting it to Kansas City to be favorite. I think Kansas City is the best team. They'll come a short favorite. I think it's going to be less than a field goal because we got some context clues already. I mean, a place like the Westgate has Kansas City like a 1-point favorite over San Francisco. Some other places out there in the marketplaces has, you know, theoretical matchups, and they have Kansas City a little bit more. I would expect the number to be Kansas City 2.5, and I would lean that way. As far as the total goes, you know, if it's KC and San Francisco, and obviously that's going to be the matchup that people probably most likely want to see, 50-51 is probably what the total will come at.
So when it's ultimately Tennessee and Green Bay, is the total like 27?
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually going to the Super Bowl, so I mean, I hate to be a fan because I'm first and foremost a fan of my pocketbook, but I think of everyone's TV executives, Green Bay, Tennessee wouldn't be preferred, but Green Bay is going to come the favorite there. I would say I'd be surprised if it's north of a field goal, to be perfectly frank with you, but certainly Rodgers and company are going to get the benefit of the doubt. Green Bay will be maybe a 2-point favorite. Total is going to sit right around 45-46.
That's Brad Powers with pregame.com and straight out of Vegas on Sports 920, the game from 3 to 4. Brad, what do you got going on this weekend? I know you guys are heading to the Super Bowl in Miami. What do you guys got cooking for conference championships?
Yeah, so we got you covered in all different ways as far as the AFC and NFC championship games go as part of the Dream Preview. And don't forget, I also do a Dream Preview college basketball edition. A couple big games tonight, including Michigan State, Wisconsin. A lot of big games tomorrow that we covered, including that big Duke-Louisville game. Make sure you're checking out all those podcasts, whether it be the College Basketball Dream Preview or the NFL one. You can check that out on any one of your favorite podcast players.
Oh, yeah, we totally urge you to do so because the information that's coming out on these Dream Previews are absolutely fantastic, and nobody does a more comprehensive job than Brad Powers. Brad, thanks you again for coming on. We'll talk to you next week, man.
All right, sounds good. Take care, guys.
All right, Brad Powers 7 on Twitter as we go through. The conference championships will take place here on ESPN Las Vegas Sunday morning following the big show at the Westgate. When we come back in 90 seconds, we'll be joined by Mike Romala from the Las Vegas Sun as we'll preview UNLV basketball home against New Mexico on Saturday. Gromala's next.
It's the Press Box.
Back to Antonio, to Mbake, to Coleman for a three, and he hit it. Marvin's hit 2 threes late, and the Rebels have their biggest lead of the game, 66-63. Loses the ball to Hendricks. Wait. Who'd they call the foul on? He tripped by himself. Tillman to Hardy in the corner, to Antonio. A three for Jonah. In and out and back in again. Jonah Antonio's hit a couple threes in the overtime. Rebels back out in front by 6 with a minute 20 to go.
Big game for the Running Rebels on Wednesday, almost catching the century mark. 98 points over on San Jose State, and big game for Jonah Antonio, too, popping five threes with 15 points. Several Rebels in double figures as they roll on and now face New Mexico at home on Saturday. And joining us now is a Rebels reporter from the Las Vegas Sun, Mike Gramala, here with us. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
We're very good, thank you. And what were your sort of first take of the win over San Jose State? They were up-tempo, a lot of players moving in a game where, you know what, they couldn't slow it down, didn't want to slow it down, and they seemed to come out on the right end because they outlasted what San Jose State couldn't do, which was keep the turnovers at bay.
My first impression was that in this streak where the Rebels have sort of resurrected themselves, you know, going 5-1 into start Mountain West play, this was the first time that it wasn't ugly. You know, they've been winning ugly. They've committed themselves to playing hard defense and hitting the floor and, you know, play just winning with effort. But against San Jose State, they won with skill and talent, and they were hitting three-pointers, and they were getting into the lane, and they looked good. It was really the first time during that stretch where, you know, they looked good and they played like a eye-pleasing style of basketball. So that's what Otzelberger wants to do long-term with the team. Not every defense they play is going to be as bad as San Jose State, so UNLV can't do that against everyone on the schedule, but for that game at least, they looked pretty good. They showed what they can be when they play that style that Otzelberger is trying to install.
So New Mexico and Nevada, their next two games, are the other two extremely fast teams in the conference, along with San Jose State. Do you think they'll still try to play fast, or will they slow these two games down?
I was surprised that they tried to run with San Jose State. Like, I was convinced that, you know, even though San Jose State is not a great team, they play fast. I didn't think UNLV would try to play their game. I thought UNLV would slow it down, hit the offensive glass, you know, try to limit possessions. And that's what I think they're going to do against New Mexico and Nevada as well. I think they're going to play it slow. San Jose State is one thing. New Mexico and Nevada are good enough to beat you if UNLV tries to play their game. I think they've had enough success, you know, slowing the game down, that that's probably their best chance to win against those teams.
You wrote up on your Twitter at Mike Gramala that T.J. Otzelberger just wants to focus on three shots, layups, three-pointers, and free throws. It seems like he's bring up more of a simplified process to at least ingrain something into an entire team philosophy.
That's the modern way of playing basketball. Those are the shots that you want. Those are the shots that if you can take more of those shots than the other team, that's how you give yourself the best chance to win. And UNLV has been pretty good at that all season long. You know, they were, you know, top 20 for most of the year in terms of the percentage of their shots are coming from three-point range or under the basket. The issue is, you know, one, they're not a good three-point shooting team. They don't really have anyone who's, you know, stands out with a great percentage. And two, they're really bad finishing around the rim. They get inside, they have trouble converting. Ibaka Jong is not a good finisher, and he's their guy that gets the most attempts around the basket. Amori Hardy gets in there once in a while. Bryce Hamilton is probably usually better on the second attempt around the rim when he can tip in his own shot. They're buying into the system and the sort of the analytical approach to what shots they want. It's just they can't really make them at this point. But it's a good sign that at least against San Jose State they were able to convert.
The key to the offense is to miss the first shot.
Yeah, I mean, if you look, Bryce Hamilton is their second best offensive rebounder, and it's usually his own shot that he's tipping in from, you know, from 6 inches away.
Okay, you said you don't think they're a good 3-point shooting team, but here's some numbers for you. First 11 games of the season, they shot 34%. Then the next six, they shot 25%. But in the last two, they're at 37%. Are you sure they're not a good 3-point shooting team?
I'm pretty sure. Like, shooting obviously goes up and down. You're going to regress to the mean. Whatever your true ability is, that's probably what you're going to be shooting at the end of the year. I don't know how much shooting improves over a season. Like, I know Jonah Antonio is a good shooter. His percentages are not there yet, but I know he can make shots. After that, who are you comfortable with, you know, just shooting a wide-open three? I mean, Hardy is hot and cold. Marvin Coleman is playing well right now. Bryce Hamilton's more of a mid-range and inside guy. It's not a team that's built with natural shooters throughout the roster. So they're making the best of what they have, but yeah, the numbers sort of, that's how I would expect it to go the rest of the year. You know, two good games, three bad games, one hot game, a couple where they can't make anything from deep. That's honestly how I would expect it to go the rest of the year, and then they'll try to find a way to win despite how they're shooting on any given night.
Running Rebels 5-1 in conference play. That's good enough for second place so far as they approach New Mexico on Saturday. Tomorrow, get your tickets at UNLVtickets.com, 739FANS, for the 3 o'clock start. Pre-game coverage begins here on ESPN Las Vegas at 1:30. When Mitru Long went out with the injury, did you expect this kind of production from Marvin Coleman?
No. Who would have expected this kind of production from Marvin Coleman? That would have been crazy. Like, at this time last year, he was a walk-on freshman who didn't play and, you know, had no, like, he's just not really a factor in the team. So fast forward 1 year for him to be, I mean, even a month ago, he was, you know, a guy who was not really factoring into the team's plans this year or even in the future, I'm not so sure. But so for him to be the team leader now and the guy over the last three games, you know, he's been their, you know, their best player. You know, three is four assists, two steals, you know, 14 points. He's playing great. No one could have expected it. But more so than on the play on the court has been the leadership, the way he's taken over the team. Basically, as soon as he got into the starting lineup, he just became the team leader. You can see the way everyone looks to him now. He speaks for the team. He leads the team on the floor. That's the most surprising thing is how quickly, you know, he could be a Band-Aid on the floor with his play. That's a little bit surprising, but the thing that's just crazy is how quickly he's become the leader of the team and the guy who just makes the team go.
But is he clutch?
T.J. Otzelberger says yes. So that's where I'm going to go with for now.
Yes, until proven otherwise?
Yeah, clutch exists for now, and Marvin Coleman is it.
They are second place in the Mountain West. They're about to play New Mexico and Nevada, who are third and fourth in the conference. Do you think they can actually finish second by the end of the year?
With the way the rest of the Mountain West is trending, I mean, they've got a win over Utah State. The worst they're going to do is split there. New Mexico is just shedding players. They're shedding starters every week, it seems. They're losing someone. Nevada is kind of pedestrian. I mean, if UNLV can capture lightning in a bottle, I don't think they're more talented than those teams. But UNLV's higher in the standings right now. Those teams will have to overtake UNLV. And, you know, the Rebels, maybe they got a little something going. Are they a team of destiny? You know, we got 12 games to figure that out. I don't know. It's 5-1. I don't think you can really – they couldn't have had a better start. You know, you're already a third of the way through the Mountain West season. This is maybe as good as it gets. If they can maintain this level of play, they're not going to go, you know, 10-2 the rest of the way. But can they go 8-4? And is that enough to hold off New Mexico and Nevada and Utah State? It might be.
You cannot use the following three words: effort, energy, or passion. Explain.
Intensity.
Okay, I got to put four on there. Intensity. Explain why they're good at defense.
I know that because I've been, for the past, you know, 3 weeks, I've been writing a story, and I've been going to the thesaurus for every story to try and find a new word to use. I don't know. I can't explain it. I don't even know. I'm not even convinced that they're playing good defense. Like, if you look at the numbers, like, they're still bad. Like all their advanced metrics, they're not great. I don't know what it is. And it's really got me flummoxed. I'm a numbers guy. Tyler, you're obviously a big numbers guy. So this is kind of going against what I think I knew about basketball, because there's really nothing that jumps out from the stat sheet that says that this team should be, you know, 5-1 in conference or a contender to finish, you know, second or third in the league. I don't know if they're good on offense. I don't know if they're good on defense, but they seem to be winning somehow. The writer in me just wants to create a narrative that says Marvin Coleman has just turned this team completely around, and he's the leader, and he's the hometown kid, and he's just got some kind of magic in him. But we both know that's not really true. That can't be true, can it?
So I don't let you use effort, energy, passion, or intensity, and you give me magic.
Magic.
Okay, so magic is what's leading to them being good on defense. That doesn't make any sense. That's not real.
Yeah, Magic Coleman. That's what we're going with.
Jesus. Well, I told you it would be 10 minutes. We'd get you out by 45, and that's magic right here. We made it happen, Mike. Mike Romala at the Las Vegas Sun, thank you again for joining us, and we'll talk to you down the road, and we'll see you tomorrow at the Thomas and Mack.
Thanks, guys.
Mike Romala with the LV Sun. All right, magic is good.
Magic Coleman.
Magic Coleman.
Here.
What about like there needs to be a nickname for this kid. I mean,
does there?
I don't know. I mean, if he continues on this run, do you use like the MC as like a Mick? Like
Mick?
Yeah, like Mick Sizzle.
How about we just steal Marvelous from Marvin Menzies? Marvelous Marvin Coleman.
He never trademarked it.
He didn't. Yeah, I don't think he did.
You got to TM that thing, man. This is Las Vegas. You got smart, bright people here ready to exploit you. It's a Press Box Morning Show. Thanks again to Mike Romala and Brad Powers. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we got to touch on what's going on with Marcus Arroyo, UNLV head football coach, because he's been in Nashville the last couple days because that's where the coaches' conferences are, where you start hiring your offensive and defensive coordinators. We'll talk about what's going on the recruiting front next.
It's the Press Box.
And obviously the guys that I believe we're going to put in front of these young men to put them and lead them and teach them are going to have the same similar philosophy. Is what pieces do we have that work, and we're not going to try to put a square peg in a round hole. Now we got to make sure we've got the elements that work, or we've got to go recruit them. But it starts with these guys right here. I know I'm smart enough to know right now we will win because of these gentlemen to start with. They're in the building and they're going to go to work right now, and they want to. They're hungry. I could sense that last night. I've done this long enough to know. I've been in their seats and been in their shoes. But we're going to be an exciting round of football that's tough and physical and plays an exciting brand of football.
UNLV head football coach Marcus Arroyo coming back. That was from the introductory press conference, as we heard in the last month. And he was trying to at least explain that, you know, when questioned about how are you going to recruit to Las Vegas, he deflected the blast by saying, look, I'm just worried about the guys here right now and getting them ready. What do we know now so far after, getting like a defensive coordinator and getting back on the recruiting front, because this period's coming up quickly?
Yeah, he's been out recruiting, has put out a lot of offers. They've gotten one commit in Noel Williams, who is a three-star defensive back. They beat out San Jose State as his most notable offer. So not really a star-studded recruit that they've got so far. But he has offered a couple of players that specifically on the defensive side that are highly rated, and if they came to UNLV, would be either the number one or number two highest-ranked defensive recruit in UNLV history.
Wow.
So he is taking a couple of big swings right now in recruiting, and we'll see if he lands any of them. My general expectation for Arroyo's recruiting this year is not all that high, right? He takes over this job in December. I'm not expecting him to go out and, because one of the kids he's offered is committed to Arizona State. Like, I'm not expecting him to go out and poach guys from Power 5 schools in a 2-month time period from when he got the job to when February signing day is. But if he does, that would be tremendous. Like, it would be unbelievable if he actually grabs two of these kids that would be, you know, the highest ranked kids that they've ever gotten on the defensive side of the ball. So that would be extremely impressive. I'm more expecting some of the Noel Williams type guys, the guys that are, all right,
okay,
you beat out San Jose State, you beat out in Eastern Washington,
yeah, Northern Arizona.
Right. Like, yeah, that's more of what I'm expecting. But if he's able to get better than that, then that's excellent, A, for just this recruiting class, but also for the projected future of what Marcus Arroyo can do in recruiting when he actually has a full year, full cycle to recruit these kids, not just jumping in late.
What do you think about some of the what would you say is the most pressing need? I mean, obviously defense. You could actually go and find like some, you know, decent guys in the JUCO level, or do you want to go that route? Is there a philosophy there? Because it seems as though he has to win as much as possible now and not be able to build the program the way Tony Sanchez was 5-6 years ago.
Yeah, I think year two is when the expectations will be there for him to be winning. I don't think year one, especially if you look at the schedule,
it seems so unrealistic.
Arizona State, Cal, Louisiana Tech, and Iowa State is the non-conference schedule. Like, they very easily could be 0-4
for sure
in conference play. Yeah. They could have their best Mountain West finish ever and still finish at 5-7. Like, if they go 5-3 in the Mountain West, it'll be like the best Mountain West season ever, and they still won't get to a bowl game. So this year, I don't think the actual expectations are there to like go to a bowl game, but year two is when that heats up. To me, the most important thing is defensive coordinator. And the RJ reported earlier this week that they are likely to hire Peter Hansen, who is the inside linebackers coach at Stanford. Mm-hmm. That is an interesting hire because he is in his early 40s. He doesn't have a ton of experience. It's not like he's inexperienced, but he's never been a defensive coordinator before. His highest profile position is inside linebackers coach at Stanford. He was with the 49ers as like a specialist or something like that for a couple of years too. So if that ends up being the guy, they are effectively taking a chance on an unknown. They could work out really well. But that, to me, is the most important thing, because UNLV, even before the Tony Sanchez era, they don't have good defensive play. They just never had good defense.
I mean, and that's being nice. I mean,
yeah,
really,
that is. You're right. You're right.
Woo, it's
like
some
they've
bad
been
defense.
Brutal on that side of the ball. They've had some good offenses, especially in the Tony Sanchez era. They had some good offenses, but they've just never been good.
And it wasn't
on
like
defense.
You could say we could fix one thing of it. You and I've sat there for many games where we're like, where do you even start to fix this thing?
It's. I mean, it's been brutal. You just look at the Sanchez era. They had a year where they had less than 10 sacks. Like, they didn't get 10 sacks in a season. So the pass rush has been a problem for a long time. The secondary has been a problem where they just give up big plays. They just get torched over the top all the time. And really, the common theme is, like, almost every year there would be one guy that would be like, oh, he's really good.
Yeah.
You know, this last year it was Javon White.
Javon White.
We had Taulo Tulele a couple years ago. Like, there's been one guy where you're like, oh, he's really good. Nobody else around him can do anything, though. So, like, they had a couple of good, like, Javon White and Rashad Jackson were actually very good players this last year. Mm-hmm. Even Jericho Flowers had a couple of big impact games, but the other eight, for the most part, were just sort of non-existent through most of the game. So, defensive coordinator to me is the most important thing. Well, if you can land four-star defensive backs, then that's going to help you. That's going to be unbelievable, because now you're actually going to have talent on that defense. But if we assume that Arroyo will recruit in the same, you know, tier as Tony Sanchez and those before him have, you're going to have to get a defense coordinator that can actually get this under-talented defense to perform, and that's just something that hasn't been possible in UNLV history.
They hired the passing game coordinator and running backs coach before they actually were able to get an OC, or have at this point, right?
Like, well, so Casey Dunn went back to Oklahoma State.
Casey Dunn went back, okay.
Yeah, so you're saying they hired Danny Langsdorf, is what you're saying. Yeah, from Fresno State.
From Fresno State, and he's been with the Mike Riley train for many years at Oregon State and the like, in Nebraska.
Yeah, so I'm curious, offensive coordinator, because we all assume Marcus Arroyo is going to call the plays.
That's what I was thinking. Like, is he going to have any more help, or is this the padding that
he
needs?
Yeah, so I'm curious what they do with that title of offensive coordinator, because conceivably you don't need it. But at the same time, you're not going to turn down having another assistant coach. Like, that is a valuable part of college football, is how many coaches you can have on staff. So I am curious what the offensive coordinator position actually is, because we expect Arroyo to be the one calling plays. But I do think that is an area for them to potentially save money, because if you look, their salary pool for assistants went from, I think it was $1.8 million last year, to $2.2 million this year. So they upped it, but not by a whole lot. And the guys they're going and pulling from other schools were making, like, their tight ends coach was making $300,000 at Washington last year.
Right, right.
That's more than any assistant coach for UNLV made last year.
In
Tim
history.
Skipper was the highest last year at $250,000. So your tight ends coach, if you hired him to the same contract that he was making at Washington, he's higher paid than your offensive coordinator and defensive coordinator were last year. That doesn't make sense. Like, that money doesn't add up. So maybe there's no offensive coordinator, and that's a way they save a bunch of money in that salary pool, or there is one, but it's not a high-paid one because you're not calling plays or anything. So that one I'm not as concerned about, because I think we're expecting Arroyo to sort of take on most of the roles of offensive coordinator, but the defensive one is certainly, I think, the most important thing he has to figure out.
I think as far as, like, in recruiting to this system, which is probably maybe Marcus's highest selling point, right? Because if you're a recruit, you're looking at the team, you're looking at you know, the conference. You really want to find a system that's going to make you shine, and no matter what. What kind of system do you think he will start running? At least with what he has right now.
So that's what I'm curious to see, because at Oregon, one of the biggest question marks this last year was they ran the ball a lot, and they wanted to be a run first team. Was that Mario Cristobal, the head coach there, that wanted that, or is that what Marcus Arroyo was calling his plays? There's a lot of questions in Oregon as to who was responsible for what they were running.
Everyone seems it's Marcus.
All Oregon fans just blame Marcus Arroyo.
Everyone does, right.
But a lot of the people are like, well, we think this is what Cristobal actually wanted to do. Now, he comes to UNLV. If he doesn't bring in a quarterback, right, he doesn't have a good quarterback on the roster. Like, Kenyon Oblad was outside the top 100. In quarterback play last year. So was Armani Rogers. So I don't know. I think you're going to lean on Charles Williams as much as you can next season, because you look at the team and you say, what are they best at? It's giving the ball to Charles Williams. So I think next year, I assume there'll be a run-heavy team, unless he goes and finds a quarterback and brings that guy in and he's able to play right away, then maybe that changes. But for year one, I would expect this team to be sort of more run heavy. And the biggest improvement you're looking for out of the passing game is, does his system allow the quarterbacks to complete a higher percentage of the short passes? Because UNLV, both Rodgers and Oblad were bad on short passes last year, like 10 percentage points below average on completing short passes. So can his system improve their game in the short and intermediate passes? Because that's where Justin Herbert was really good.
That's right. That's what actually made him shine. And we saw a lot of that in the Rose Bowl, to be honest with you. Like, he didn't have to go in and challenge guys downfield. There was a very, like, simplified ball control offense. And maybe that's something that would be a change of pace here in Las Vegas. It's Tyler and Clay on your Friday. We have to take a break because Ed Graney's waiting live. He's got the thermals on. He's wrapped up. The nose is frozen as he heads to Montreal in Canada. We'll join Ed Graney next.
Right now is the best time to book your pool renovations. If your pool is looking tired and outdated, now is the time to call B&D Plastering. Book your job by January 31st and get 2019 pricing. Call B&D Pool Plastering, 702-644-8980.
This spring, get in the game and earn cash for betting sports with William Hill on your phone or tablet. During